Lord Chris Patten is one of Britain's big political beasts, not only as a commentator, thinker, and writer about Britain, Europe, and the world, but through a formidable career where he's had the chance to put his ideas into action. He has been a British cabinet minister, chair of the Conservative Party, European Commissioner for External Relations, governor of Hong Kong, chair of the BBC, and latterly, Chancellor of Oxford University. Taken together, including a stint as chair of the Independent Commission on Policing in Northern Ireland, it's one of the most distinguished records of public service in Britain. He recently retired from the Chancellorship of Oxford, writing with a typical humour that he'd rather be present at a commemorative dinner than a memorial service, at which his active presence would necessarily be limited. All his predecessors had died in office, whatever their health. It was time to break with that tradition. Hardly a conservative position for a former chair of the Tory party, but for those who know him, it was unsurprising. Lord Patten has tried to put the good of whatever institution he has served first, true to a rich tradition in British political life, liberal conservatism, of which he is a member, but which currently, I suspect he would agree, is under siege. Welcome to the Buoy Society podcast. A lot to discuss.
Thanks very much indeed, Will.
Now, the first question I'm going to ask is the same as I ask all our guests. Now, when you were invited to be on the We Society podcast, I mean, what was your first thought? You had We Society, curious name, or what was the first thoughts that came into your mind? How would you understand that phrase?
The first thing that I thought about was the whole business of identity politics. And I've written from time to time about what we means and who we are. And I've sometimes written about that in relation to things which I can't stand, like the most limited sorts of English nationalism. And some people would still define we like the Flanders and Swan song. The English, the English, the English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all of the rest. But that sort of we is not one I like. What I think of as we is a tradition, a community which is civil, which is clubbable, which is courageous when it needs to be, which has a shared history, but is very tolerant about people who have different views about that history. So that's my we. And I realise that to some extent I've come to that judgment because of the things that have happened to me down the years, beginning with being an undergraduate in Oxford, where my moral tutor, this was a young Catholic scholarship boy, my moral tutor was the greatest Marxist historian of the last, one of the two greatest of the last 70 or 80 years, an atheist Marxist, who I think was one of the reasons why I learned...
This is Christopher Hill.
This is Christopher Hill, yeah, the great 17th century historian. I learnt the difference between a quarrel and an argument. And I think that's at the root of my understanding of what we means.
I think that's pretty congruent with what we try to do on this podcast. First question, I guess, is that looking at contemporary Britain, if you had to identify two, three things that you believe social science should address, this is a social science podcast, in which you think whatever government of the day should address, what would those things be?
Well, they'd be related to the views of my favourite political philosopher, Michael Oakeshott. And you wouldn't take his views on married life, I don't think. He sort of moved on a lot in that department. As Iris Murdoch would be able to tell you if she was still alive. But I think he's the most wonderful and balanced philosopher about consensus and accommodation and the importance of institutions and the importance of ultimately, even if you think that you need to be very careful about changing things lest you make them worse. I mean, the passage in one of his books which expresses that most clearly begins by saying that, ends by saying that the most important thing in life is that present laughter is more important than ultimate bliss. And I think, to some extent, we've been knocked about, first of all, by a lack of commitment to any sort of philosophy or any sort of philosophy which reflects that. Secondly, I think we've been knocked about by forgetting about civility and culpability and those other things of his. We've been affected by the fact that both our main political parties have been corroded over the last few years partly by their own internal democracy. And I think we're in a mess partly because of that. Would we say now, like sort of Pericles, that our system was an education to the world? I mean, what are you boast about?
No.
Parliament, which has taken back control, thank you very much. The quality of our public debate, the extent to which serious issues are affected by appeal to tabloids. I mean, it's awful. I think that there are, too many people who go into politics because I think it's a very good living. Too many people who go into politics, not because they believe in something passionately, but because it's just another career, like being a chartered accountant. I think that a lot of people still go into politics without any set of broad principles which they're going to stick by. And I think some people go into politics, even today, who are unembarrassable. I mean, I think it's extraordinary. And there are too many who think it's all about getting on. Matthew Parris was referring the other day to...
He's a columnist in the Times, yeah.
Yeah.
The former Tory MP.
Some of the MPs that were around when he was first into politics, like the one he talked about in particular was Bonner Pink. People who were older, many of whom had fought in the Second World War, who had a sense of public duty, didn't go into politics because they thought they were going to become ministers. They were never going to become ministers, but because they thought they owed it to the community. They weren't paid very much money. They didn't go into it for the money. I remember one of them who I'd once shared an office with called Carol Mather, and one of my best friends, Carol Mather went into the Whip's office, and one of my best friends was in the Whip's office as well, Tristan Garrel Jones. And Tristan, who spent most part of his life in Spain, used to dress a bit like a European. And he had a great load coat, which he used to wear in the winter. And he wandered into the Whip's office one day, and Carol Mather looked at him and said, "My God, Tristan," he said, "the last time I saw people dressing that sort of coat, I shot him." So there was that sort of generation of MPs who were just there to do some good for their community. And it was the same on the Labour Party side with councillors and trade unionists who never thought they'd become Chief Secretary of the Treasury or would have hated the idea and maybe propped up the bar in the House of Commons too much, but were nevertheless decent people who were doing what they thought was service for the community.
If a political scientist is kind of listening to this and thinking, you know, you're right, you know, there is this degradation kind of the public square, what reforms could you imagine might make it better? You know, I mean, what you said isn't hard to argue with, but I mean, given where we are now, how would one kind of get to a better place?
Well, it's extremely difficult because what you can't suggest is that in a way both political parties have been corroded by too much internal democracy. A friend of mine, who Nelson Polesby, who wrote, he's now last dead, probably the best books on Congress, argued very persuasively that when a party becomes internally too democratic, it moves to the extremes, because the people who prepared to go out in the middle of the night in February pushing things through letterboxes tend to be the most rabidly ideological. And I think, but you couldn't actually do that today. I think you can only hope that example and a bit of success, because we look to many people now like a failing nation, that some success and some decency and some leadership which inspires a bit of confidence and enthusiasm may start to make a difference. I mean, at university, I don't find many people who are enthusiastically thinking about going into politics. At one of my grandson's schools the other day, where I was speaking, I asked the teacher who was responsible. It's a great school. What the boys were all doing, what we're going to do in their sixth form. And he said, well, they're all going to do maths and double maths. I said, why? He said, well, they want to become hedge fund managers or bankers.
Or coding. Digital coding, yeah.
Yep, yep. And in fact, he said, I asked, how many are doing German in the sixth form? He said, four. And it's slightly depressing that we're sort of narrowly focused on things like that. And to some extent, we are at the age of 16, 17, 18, even younger.
We should discuss, I think, contemporary geopolitics. You know, you've been governor of Hong Kong. Let's start with China. There's Ukraine to discuss. The Americans are just about to give TikTok 9 months to kind of dispose of their ownership in the States because they say the users of TikTok, over 100 million of them in America, could be exposed to the Chinese Communist Party having their data. It's part and parcel of a growing suspicion in the West about China's intentions. Do you share this?
Yeah, I do. And I'm surprised that we've spent so long wondering about whether we could call China a threat. I mean, the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee, the MI5, MI6, have all set out in some detail the way in which China threatens our interests and those of liberal democracies. And for me, it's an open and shut argument. When Xi Jinping came to power, one of the first things he did was to give an instruction to the party and government cadres that they should wage an intense struggle against, and then they list all the things which are dangerous to, which are an existential threat to Chinese communism, parliamentary democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of association, civil society. They go through what looks like a perfect description of, say, Hong Kong. And if they were saying they had to fight all these things, it didn't mean that you could regard them as anything but a bit of a threat. So it's not the West going back into sort of Cold War attitudes to take that view. It is actually happening.
Yeah.
And it's happening with cybersecurity, attacks. Anne Applebaum, whom I have huge admiration for, wrote a piece recently about Taiwan, saying that people say, you know, will there be a war against Taiwan? There's already, in a sense, a war on Taiwan. If you look at what the Chinese are doing with cybersecurity in relation to Taiwan and how the Taiwanese are reacting. So what I say is not a criticism of Chinese people or the Chinese nation. The people who worked for me in Hong Kong were Chinese. They were Chinese patriots. But they didn't define their patriotism in terms of whether they loved the Communist Party. The people who formed the public in Hong Kong. We write in the history books, the communists, after, you know, in the last few years, have said that Hong Kong was never a colony. It was an occupied territory. Well, who occupied it? It was occupied by refugees from communism, who'd found a great sort of moral affront to the Chinese communists, had found refuge in a British colony, for God's sake. So my first point is that we should be open-eyed about China. We shouldn't be deluded. And sooner or later, I hope, that there'll be the sort of changes in China which we were starting to see in a way with Zhu Rongji and Jiang Zemin and so on in the past. But we have deluded ourselves. With collective leadership. When China joined the WTO, Tony Blair said the Chinese road to democracy was now unstoppable. Well, there was understandable that self-delusion that sooner or later...
That was shared by the Americans.
It's actually a Marxist view that economic change will produce... and technological change will produce political change sooner or later. Well, maybe, but, you know, it could be a lot later. So the first point is that we shouldn't kid ourselves about China. We should want to work with China when it's in our interest and the globe's interest. We should continue to
talk to them about matters of common interest, but we shouldn't be frightened by them. And we shouldn't feel that we always have to accept the mandate of heaven, that they're beyond criticism. You take an issue like coronavirus. In 2020, in the beginning of 2020, the then Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi went to Australia. There was already support reports about something happening in Wuhan, some sort of illness or disease. And Wang Yi was asked about this and said, there was a small problem, but that it was perfectly manageable, it wasn't transmissible, and they had it under control. At the same time, the Chinese were buying hand-over-fist PPE equipment from Australia. So not surprisingly, the Australians, when everybody saw what was happening, said that WHO should have a look at it. At which point, the Chinese, horrified, announced they're not going to buy anything from Australia. Barley, iron ore, Western Australian wines. Of course, sooner or later, they had to, because they needed them. But for a time, people were taking the view, we can't ever annoy the Chinese because they'll stop doing business with them, despite the fact that they have huge surpluses with us, for example, Europe, for example, Britain.
It's asymmetric.
It's asymmetric. So the first thing I feel strongly about is that we shouldn't treat China as though it was totally different from every other country. It's not.
If you enjoy the We Society podcast, you may also enjoy the Slow Newscast from Tortoise Media. The Slow Newscast is an investigative podcast that aims to tell a fresh, exciting story each week by focusing on the stories that really matter in the UK and around the world. From the war in Ukraine, the downfall of Boris Johnson, to true crime and injustice and real-life mysteries, the Slow Newscast team is devoted to narrative investigations. From a startup newsroom with a different approach to journalism, the Slow Newscast offers a more in-depth take on a single story than the flurry of daily news. There'll be fresh investigations looking at everything from extreme sports to corruption and assassinations. So if you want to slow down, look up the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
China is a significant supporter of Russia. It's not clear how much direct assistance they're giving with military equipment.
But certainly technical.
But certainly they're buying Russian grain and Russian...
At a good price, because they can drive a hard bargain.
Yeah, and they are doing so, we know. Which gets us to Russia, you know, holding around 20% now Ukraine's land area. They've more than 100 square miles have been won in the last kind of 6 to 8 weeks. We know it's menacing. I mean, that's common ground. I mean, at last, the Americans have come up with a package of support, along with European support. We know what's at stake here, but just give us a sense from where you sit about how serious it is. There are those who say we've gone from a post-war to a pre-war kind of condition. Grant Chaps makes those points. We should start to put Western democracies on a war footing. I think it's common agreement we should be alert to the threat, but how alert?
Well, I think it's common ground that we cashed in the peace dividend a bit too early and a bit too comprehensively. And we have, over the years, cut defence spending far too much, not just here, but elsewhere. If you look at the NATO contributions to defence, I think I'm right in saying that much fewer than half the members of NATO reached the NATO commitment to spend 2% of GDP on defence. And when you look at some budgets, Belgium, for example, and consider that the amount of their defence spending, which has to go on pensions, you start to think that what they're actually giving the world is the best defended pension fund existing. So, of course, we should do more, and we should recognise that we're in the present situation because again and again we said we were prepared to fight for our values. Again and again, Putin didn't believe us and turned out to be right. Turned out to be right, from Estonia in 2007 with the cyber attacks, Georgia in 2008 with South Ossetia and Abkhazia in effect dragged away from Georgia, 2014 with Crimea, Syria with the Russians supporting Assad after the chemical weapons attacks, and with President Obama, who one is loath to criticise, saying that use of chemical weapons would be a red line. And then the red line turned out to be very pink. And if at each of those occasions President Putin calls our bluff and gets away with it, it's not surprising. He thought he could do the same with Ukraine. And the main reason why he hasn't got away with it in Ukraine isn't because of us. It's because of the Ukrainians. Who have fought so spectacularly, so gallantly for their own nation, which isn't a core part of Russia. And it's part of the Putin sort of tsarist paranoid view of the world that makes him think it is. And I think that if Ukraine goes, or if we connive at making the Ukrainians sign up to a bad deal with Russia, then there'll be somebody else next. And why would anybody elsewhere in the world believe American or European commitments to them?
It's a bit unfair, but I'm going to ask you all the same. What's going to bring peace to the Middle East?
A commitment on both sides, both the Israeli and the Palestinian sides, to a two-state solution. I mean, it's not rocket science. I had some great friends that I worked with. Perhaps friends is too strong, but people I much admired in the Israeli government, like Yossi Beilin, the Minister of Justice, like the then foreign minister. They were passionate supporters of Israel, but recognised that the best way to support Israel was to have an accommodation with the Palestinians, which would stop another generation of people killing one another. And they've been driven out of politics by Netanyahu politics. The best thing I've read about the Middle East recently was a piece in Foreign Affairs by the editor of Haaretz, the liberal Jewish newspaper. He's a very, very good man, setting out how Netanyahu has campaigned vigorously against the two-state solution, who always clearly, with some others on the right in Israeli politics, thought that it was important to keep the Palestinians split between Fatah and Hamas. So, any Palestinian arguments for going along with the two-state solution would be devalued by the fact that they didn't have a good and coordinated leadership. So I don't see any other way in which we deal with that, though it becomes more and more difficult.
We finished this interview off, it's a social science podcast. I mean, a lot of the things you've discussed, you know, kind of are the kind of subject and matter of political scientists, geographers, economists, sociologists, you know. Here you are, kind of looking at your career in the round, looking back. I mean, could social science play a bigger role? Should it play a bigger role? What's your view of social science?
I think it's quite interesting that even though we have extraordinary excellence in the social sciences as elsewhere, you don't see as much of an impact made by our academics on framing public policy as you find in the United States. And I think that's sad and something we should be able to address, because certainly some of the problems that we face, whether the lack of a sensible labour market policy being one very obvious example, with the relationship between education, vocational training, higher education, public sector employment, public sector pay, all those things coming together. Because, you know, there's clearly a great relationship between immigration numbers and training and pay. When I was in hospital recently in the intensive care unit where I was, all the wards around it, there was one nurse out of 16 who was British. And it's got all sorts of things to do with the values that we tell kids about, with what they pay boys and girls who are prepared to go into nursing and so on. And it all has an impact on immigration. It has an impact on all these other things. So social scientists helping us with that. And social scientists helping us, as well as politicians and people who've read Oakeshott.
Who's a social scientist, of course.
Yep. Helping us with answering the biggest question of my political life. Rab Butler, who was one of the tragedies of post-war politics, is that Rab Butler and Macmillan didn't get on well, to put it mildly. Rab Butler was, the 1944 Education Act, greatest chancellor, great Home Secretary, probably the best person at turning good ideas into practical policy and legislation. A friend of mine was, when I was a young researcher in the Conservative Party, was down in with Rab's one weekend, helping Rab with a speech. And when he's going, Rab says to him, "Oh, take some flowers back for your wife." And my friend goes out into the garden with Butler. And Butler had a bad arm and was cutting the flowers in this extraordinary down sort of chop. And there he is cutting the flowers. And my friend says to him, "Come on, Rab," he says, "what's the most important lesson you've learned in public life?" And he said, "Oh, that's simple." He said, "It's more important to be generous than efficient." And of course, he didn't mean it literally, that you didn't have to be efficient. But there is a sort of political philosophy wrapped up in that, which I've often wanted to try to write about myself. But it is true, both because it's the heart of what a welfare democracy should be all about. So I'd hope that people would find an answer to that question, because we're poorer in relation to other countries than we were. There are inequalities across the country, whether you're talking about health or money or esteem, which weren't here before. All of those things we've got to deal with. Otherwise, our kids and our grandchildren are going to have a hell of a time.
Look, Pat, thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Have any suggestions for guests, feedback for the programme? Email us on wesociety@acss.org.uk. And above all, thank you for listening.